Hey guys, welcome to episode 118 of the OCDstories.com podcast. Now in this episode, I interviewed Ethan Smith. I met Ethan briefly before at the ISDF conference last year, and I interviewed him along with Jeff Szymanski from the ISDF, I believe in 2016 or 2017, either way. Ethan was at Chrissy's OCD Game Changers event in Denver this year, so I got to spend some real quality time with Ethan. It was a pleasure to get to know him, find out more about his life story, his journey, and what he's doing now and in OCD advocacy, and it's really inspiring. And little background on Ethan, he's a professional writer, director, and producer. He's also a national ambassador for the charity the ISDF. And we talk about many things. We talk about his story, which is fascinating. He's so vulnerable with it and open, and I really respect and appreciate that. And I think you guys will too. We ask the general sort of questions around kind of what therapies have helped, his turning point, any problem areas in treatment, dealing with lapses or relapses, his advocacy work. So, you know, we briefly talk about a few things like obviously ERP, how that massively helped him. He talks about acceptance and commitment therapy, how that also played a part in his recovery, which is interesting to see. And he breaks down the parts of acceptance and commitment therapy that helped him in particular. We talk about the need for self-compassion, how nature can be a support or has been for him. Talk about choices and decisions and things like motivation in this. It's a really broad, I think, well-rounded episode. He's a funny guy as well, so I think this should be an easy listen for you guys and an informative one. And don't forget, if you want to become a member, get extra episodes and more benefits, head over to theocdstories.com/join. So without further ado, here is Ethan.
On the podcast today, I have Ethan Smith. Ethan is a professional writer, director, and producer. He's also a national ambassador for the charity, the IOCDF. Welcome back to the show, Ethan.
Thanks for having me, Stuart. I'm glad to be back.
Yeah, no, it's my pleasure to have you on again. And obviously, the first time was with you and Jeff Szymanski, and we were talking about the ISDF. So if anyone's interested in finding out more about the charity, to go listen to that episode, or I'm sure it will come up in this one too. So before we get into kind of some of the questions around recovery, it'd just be good to hear your OCD story in as little as much detail as you want to go into.
Okay, great. So I was born with OCD and struggled with it most of my life as a kid. I like to call it, you know, the more traditional OCD, counting, checking, a lot of physical compulsions. As I got into high school, sort of morphed into fear of illness and fear of sickness. I was a hypochondriac. You know, a headache was a brain tumor and a fever was meningitis. I carried thermometers around with me. I took my temperature 60, 70 times a day. And around the age of 14, I finally got diagnosed with OCD. And you would think, at least for me, or for many people, I think, being diagnosed is a relief, you know, because you finally learn that, you know, oh, it's not just me. There's something diagnosable. There's a name to this and something can be done.
Yeah.
And for me, it was a little bit of a different situation. I was diagnosed with OCD, so it was great to have a name, I guess, but nothing really changed in terms of what I'd already been doing with therapists and psychologists. It was mostly just talk therapy. The only difference was they put me on Prozac, which helped some with the OCD, but in terms of treatment, nothing really changed. And so as I went through high school and college in my early 20s, and I dropped out of college after 3 months because of the OCD, and sort of went from formative teenage years into adult years and, you know, starting to take on adult responsibilities, my OCD would continue to get worse. And I would continue to see therapists who were, quote, you know, licensed in treating OCD. And again, we would just talk about myself and my childhood and sort of just process versus, you know, the cognitive behavioral therapy and exposure response prevention. Which is obviously the first line treatment of OCD and evidence-based. So a couple things were happening during this time. My OCD was getting worse. My world was becoming smaller and I was losing hope because, you know, every so often I would get with a new psychologist in the hopes that this person could finally help me. And then, you know, ultimately nothing worked and that I would just, you know, lose that little glimmer of hope. sort of all came to a head at the beginning of 2010, a sort of perfect storm of events where my grandfather passed away and my girlfriend broke up with me and some medication differences. And I really just fell into the depths of OCD hell and became unable to function, completely unable to function. I'd lost 100 pounds. I had to be fed by my parents because I was afraid I was going to accidentally poison myself. I was afraid I was going to hurt myself. It was all self-harm related OCD. And, you know, that was sort of the best thing that could have happened to me and the worst thing that could have happened to me. I don't know if it inevitably would have happened, that I would have reached that point had sort of that perfect storm not happened. But because I reached that point, that's what eventually led me to the right therapy and a year and a half of really intensive treatment. With ERP, ACT, acceptance commitment therapy, DBT, dialectical behavioral therapy, a couple interventions, some rough times. It was definitely an interesting experience. And I don't want to take up the whole time. So if anybody's interested in the entire story, if they just Google Ethan Smith keynote, the keynote speech that I gave in 2014 at the International OCD Foundation Conference, that's my whole story in detail. And you can learn more there. But after a year and a half of life-changing treatment, and I mean, by no means a straight line, it was down and up and down and up, and I thought I was going to die, and I mean, it was nuts. But, you know, I finally got to a point where survival became more important than the OCD, and I realized that nobody could rescue me but me. That in combination with the help from my parents, and by help from my parents, I mean them backing out of the picture, not taking an active role in rescuing me, learning, you know, what enabling and reassuring was and how they had to sort of let me go to get me back. So them being able to do that and let the clinicians, you know, do what they needed to do, that combination enabled me to sort of step up to the plate and make the hard decision, which was to either let the OCD get the best of me or, you know, take a chance and sort of jump over the cliff, even though I really didn't know where I was going to land. So about 8.5 months later, I was in Boston at the time. I moved out to Los Angeles, sort of in maintenance with OCD, and it's been almost 8 years. It'll be 8 years in September since then. So it's been quite a journey.
Wow, no, that's awesome. Obviously, I know your story. You shared it with us in Denver. And it's a real, real touching story, you know, many ups and downs. Which I'm sure if they listen to that keynote, they get a far more detailed picture of it. And I'll definitely link to that in the show notes.
Awesome, thank you.
No worries. So, you know, the bit you said there about the kind of either letting OCD win or just really going for it and that epiphany of learning that I need to save myself, no one else is going to do it. Kind of, what really made that come about, if you can pinpoint something?
Yeah, that's a hard question for me to answer. And I think I've only gotten better at it recently. You know, it's sort of that the shift moment. When did you shift? When were you able? I think, you know, people with OCD are relatively intelligent, creative people. And I think we understand the concept of treatment and therapy pretty early on. It's, you know, whether we can buy into it and trust it and sort of flip the switch ourselves. That becomes the real differentiator between just understanding treatment and really engaging it yourself and you know, utilizing it. And for me, I know that through most of my treatment and therapy, once I found the proper treatment at 31, you know, I understood what ERP was backwards and forwards, but I just couldn't figure out how to do it. I really couldn't. I couldn't figure out how to buy into it. I was scared. I was certain that it was irresponsible, that it was dangerous. I mean, I had 31 years of thought patterns and habits built in, you know, where, you know, these people that I don't know are telling me to think and do otherwise. And it was so terrifying to me that I really had trouble engaging in it and sort of giving myself over to it, which is kind of what's necessary. One of the reasons I advocate and one of the reasons I speak is because I personally had to get to a place that was more or less a life or death situation in order for me to understand what it means to sort of engage ERP, engage treatment, engage the new way of thinking and embrace it. And really, it was a circumstance of no longer being able to indulge the OCD. I was already, despite 8 months of 5 sessions a day, 5 days a week outpatient, and then 2.5 months of residential treatment, despite, you know, almost a year solid of literally multiple times a day treatment, the fact that I was still so sick, you know, I thought there was no hope. I thought that surely I had OCD that no one else had, and that I was special, and that, you know, I was a lost cause. What ended up happening was, you know, they put me in this position where nobody was coming for me. Nobody was going to call me. Nobody was going to rescue me, in so much as no one was going to bring me food or water or help me shower. I mean, I was literally alone in a room in a dangerous, not a super dangerous, well, in a kind of crummy part of town, in a house that, you know, I had found on Craigslist, and sort of, and as much as I felt alone and abandoned at the time, it was the best thing that ever happened to me, because it really made me realize that I can stand up. Like, I can stand up. I'm not incapable of physically standing up and getting out of bed and moving one foot in front of the other, despite how paralyzing the OCD felt.
Yeah.
And it was in that moment that I realized that's what I have to do in order to move forward, or I'll just die. And so, you know, doing a real deep gut check and asking myself, you know, did I want to die? I mean, despite all that suffering and pain, I just didn't. I didn't want to. I'd already been through all of this. It would have been for nothing. I didn't want to leave the people that I loved. I just felt like there was more in store for me. And this couldn't be how it all ended. And so suddenly, this whole complication of treatment and ERP, it came down to just get out of bed. It's literally what it came down to. Just get up. Stand up. Mm. That's all you have to do. And my whole world was broken down into moments. And suddenly the fear of what if I die because I'm going to do X, Y, and Z was a better option than I'm definitely going to die because I'm not doing those things. And slowly but surely, you know, I started to get better. But as I said before, the reason I advocate is I don't want anybody to ever have to get to that point. I would be in therapy and residential treatment, and I would see people engaging ERP, a lot of people, and they would, you know, they would touch a trash can, hold it for 10 seconds, get really anxious. Then it would curve. Then they'd give their suds and they'd say, oh, I'm a 3. And then they touch it again. It would go up to a 9 or a 10. And I'd see how it would work. And I would say, why can't I do that? That doesn't happen for me. I don't understand that, you know, and, you know, maybe their OCD is less severe. Maybe they didn't go through 31 years. Everybody's, you know, obviously journey is completely different, and no less serious, no less painful, no less traumatic. But all I know is, you know, 31 years of sort of being OCD slave and reinforcing that type of behavior, undoing that was a nightmare. And so if I can play some small role in helping others not have to go through that, if they can hear the letters ERP, you know, 3 years after they're diagnosed, which is still pitiful, but if they can hear that instead of 20 years, then I know that I'm doing something important, and that my first 30 years wasn't for nothing, you know?
Yeah, no, really good messages there. And I agree, like, you know, 3 years is still too slow, but it's like, it's way better than, as you say, what they potentially would have gone through. Especially back in the day, you know, when there were no podcasts, there was no ISDF, there was no Ethan Smith. You know, people went probably way longer than 12 years or whatever the average is. And so, yeah, I think, you know, your advocacy work is important because it is reducing that time. And some people are lucky, they're going to get a diagnosis, they're going to have a good therapist, and the therapist is going to say, you need to go check out this resource, this person's story. And that's going to be all they need. And it's going to, you know, they'll have a week, you know, before they know what ERP is, which is awesome.
That'd be amazing. Yeah. And you know, Stuart, I feel like two things had to be undone, you know, mm-hmm. which is why it's also important to spread the message and just talk about it and destigmatize it. Was before they can even address the OCD, I mean, what I realized in retrospect is they had to address the hope. They had to get through my walls, which, you know, after 12 therapists and 17 years after diagnosis were, you know, 500 miles thick. And so in order for them to just even break my walls down to get to a place to believe them that, you know, why is this different than all the other therapies that I've tried? You know, so at least to be able to not have to go through that process and be able to just have hope, you know, after discovering and going into treatment for the first time and having it be the right treatment. And I mean, there's just so much hope out there for people, and I'm very optimistic.
Yeah, no, I agree. And that's a good message to share. And I like something you said there. And it's something I've said a few times, and I always feel weird saying it because I know it's a tough message to say. And I know it's not as simple as I say it, but I say it because it's possible, not because it's easy. And that's when you said you realized you just had to get out of bed. Like the feeling was just an emotion. It wasn't actually paralyzing your body to the point that you couldn't move a single limb and get out of bed. It was the emotion and the thought that was stopping you, not the what's the word I'm trying to use, physiology. You know, you were still a fully, you know, able to get out of bed. And often, especially when depression's in tow, which makes it even harder to feel any energy or motivation to move anywhere. But you had that epiphany, that realization of this isn't easy, this painful, and this sucks, but I'm in control here. And I think it's that realizing to a point that no matter how shitty you feel, you still have a decision.
Like, yeah.
Yeah.
That's a great point. Yeah. It's always a choice. And that's why, you know, when you learn to listen to the words you're using when you're in the throes of OCD, you say a lot of, I can't, I can't, I can't, I can't. And, you know, when you break that down, you physically can, it's more of an, I won't. It is a choice, even though it doesn't feel like it. I mean, it's so easy for you and I to say, oh, it's you won't. I mean, you know, it definitely, you feel paralyzed. It's amazing that a mental illness can completely paralyze you. I looked like I had cancer at my worst. Mm-hmm. But recognizing at a certain point that it is a choice, and then you have a choice on what to do. You have options. And I'll tell you, man, you know, those days in Boston, moving forward after that, I mean, you know, I took it with me. I mean, I cried every day. I got to a point where my therapist was literally like, look, I don't care how you feel, just go do it. I don't care if you're crying. I don't care if you're this. I remember just going to work every day at Guitar Center at the time, selling keyboards behind Fenway Park. And I would cry almost all day. And I got to a point where I just didn't care anymore. Like, I was like, whatever, this is how I feel. You know, I go into the bathroom, cry for 5 minutes, go back out, sell a keyboard, go back to the bathroom, cry, have my OCD thoughts, go back out. And you know what? I mean, like, I could go home the next day. And guess what? I didn't feel good. I still didn't feel good. Sometimes they'll say, oh, just go do it and you'll feel better. I didn't feel better. But something deep down, there's that subconscious message that's given to yourself when you spend a day doing value-driven activities that somewhere deep down it says, you know, you did this today and this was a better choice than listening to OCD or staying in bed. And over time, that goes from subconscious to conscious, and that gets louder and louder to a point where that really becomes a large motivator. But it starts as something you don't even notice is happening. You just have to do it.
Yeah, really good point. And I love the book Man's Search for Meaning by Viktor Frankl, who was a psychiatrist. He created logotherapy, which originally was used, I think, for OCD. I wouldn't advocate for it now, but historically it was. But that book's brilliant because it talks all about obviously the concentration camps in Nazi Germany at the time. And he talks about that you always have a choice, no matter how bleak your situation is. And obviously he was facing near death at the time. He was seeing people die all around him. So trigger warning for anyone here. But he realized that even so, all this horrible stuff is happening. He has a choice about how he feels or how he chooses to live his life in that moment. And I feel that's such a powerful message and a powerful book because he's telling it not from a rosy position. He's telling it from a really horrible situation, both mentally and physically. So that book, I think, you know, really helped me get that kind of epiphany. But where you were talking there about, you know, value-led life, I know you did some ACT with a therapist. It'd be good just to see how that type of therapy, what did it teach you?
Yeah, ACT was a game changer for me. And it's funny, I've done three interviews today, and you're the third person to bring up Viktor Frankl.
Awesome.
Ironically enough, I mean, he just kind of goes hand in hand with, you know, I mean, it doesn't do it justice to say he made a good thing out of a bad situation,
yeah.
You know?
Read the book, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, he was able to find beauty in life despite where he was and the conditions he was in. And that's kind of remarkable. It's like, you know, dictating life on your own terms, despite whatever the external forces are. And it's not easy, but it's powerful. Yeah. So for me, you know, ACT was a big time game changer. And when I got out of, when I sort of went through that intervention where I was, you know, on the streets of Boston and sort of living life and not having anybody to turn to, except I was able to go to therapy. But wasn't able to talk to my parents and sort of recreating a new life for myself. They actually stopped doing exposure response prevention at that point. I learned everything there was to learn. There was nothing more for me to do. And they introduced acceptance commitment therapy and dialectical behavioral therapy, DBT, which is, as you know, helps with emotional regulation. But ACT impacted me on a couple of ways. And I was actually kind of aggravated that it wasn't introduced earlier in my treatment. For me, it totally changed my relationship to my thoughts. And I mean, we always hear, oh, your thoughts are just leaves floating on a river, or you hear sort of the analogies, and like, that's all fine and good. But for some reason, the way, you know, ACT breaks down thoughts into different analogies and symbolism and things like that, that started to make sense to me, the way we observe our thoughts, how we respond to our thoughts, what our thoughts actually are, the kind of meaning and power we give them, and then identifying what's important in your life and you know, what are your values and goals and dreams, and how your thoughts interact, just how everything interacted with each other. It all really put everything into context for me. And what it did was, and hopefully if somebody is in treatment now and they're listening to this, this helps, because this was a big, huge difference for me, was that when I started learning about values through ACT, I would hear all the time in treatment doctors or therapists say, well, don't you want to fight your OCD? Come on, fight your OCD. And I never knew what that meant. It was just such an ambiguous term to me. Like, what does that mean, fight my OCD? I don't even understand what you're talking about. I know that you don't want me to do these things. What does that mean to fight your OCD? And when I started getting involved in acceptance commitment therapy and mindfulness and being present, I suddenly realized that fighting your OCD, you know, is more than just resisting. It's more than just some sort of personification of punching OCD in the face. It's making choices that directly impact your life negatively or positively. And what I mean by that is, I realized when I would choose OCD, or so when I would choose to engage a ritual or compulsion brought on by a feeling, brought on by a thought, that I was also actively choosing not to do something that was important to me. And when I started to make specific what those things were, treatment for me and how I approach treatment just as myself, as my own therapist going through this, completely changed. So no longer was it I was fighting OCD. I was choosing to meet a girl, or I was choosing to go out that night with friends and have dinner. I was choosing to enjoy dinner. I was choosing to look at the sunset or the sunrise, and choosing those values, I wasn't choosing OCD. And so instead of sort of framing it as I'm not choosing OCD or I'm fighting OCD, I chose it as, well, if I choose OCD, then I'm literally choosing not to do any of those things. So suddenly it became, what am I choosing not to do? And I started defining those things on a very personal level, what I was choosing not to do. So now I would get to that fork in the road when you're first starting treatment and the thoughts slow down to a point where you feel like you have a choice to choose between OCD and not, it would be very clear for me, well, if I choose OCD, then I'm actively choosing to give up all of these things that are important to me. And that was big. That was really big for me.
Yeah, that's really good to hear. And that's a really good explanation. Of the choice point, as you're familiar, is what they call it in ACT, where you can either at any given moment, I guess it kind of goes back to Viktor Frankl, you can either choose to go towards what you want or away from it. And in every second of every day of our lives, we always have a choice. And I think it's, as you say, it's keeping that at the forefront of your mind. It empowers you. Do I want to keep going down this downward spiral, or do I want to, you know, as hard as it is, start to go in the direction of my goals and values? And I feel just having that you almost have that choice empowers people, because I feel a lot of time with OCD or any kind of mental disorder or illness, you feel like you don't have a choice. And I think that's the biggest lie that our brains tell us.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. It was interesting, not to tangent on this other podcast I recently did. We were talking about the duality of OCD and how you have sort of this healthy brain at war with your OCD all the time. And you know what you're doing is illogical. You know that it doesn't make sense. You know that you don't want to, and yet you can't, you know, you do it anyway.
Yeah.
And sort of this, the guilt and the stigma that, that comes along with that. And when she brought that up, it immediately reminded me of when I was in a couple of acute psychiatric facilities, and I would watch these people that were truly in psychosis. They were psychotic, schizophrenia, or whatever. And at first, I was very jealous of them. And I was jealous because they weren't aware of the pain they were in. And, you know, and I envied that because, you know, they may have been paranoid, or they may have thought they see something, but they weren't aware that what they were doing wasn't right. I hate to use the word crazy, but, you know, unlike when we're struggling with OCD, it's like, you know, I know I don't have to wash my hands 100 times. This is ridiculous. And yet I got to do it anyway. And so I really envied these individuals because they didn't have that awareness of this double thing. They were just, their reality was their reality. And I felt like they weren't experiencing that level of pain that we feel. The reason I bring this up and the reason it comes back around now is they didn't have a choice either, which is then makes me grateful that I had OCD, because with that pain and with that suffering and with that sort of wherewithal is also that ability to have that choice. Mm-hmm. And it's because of that dual relationship. It's because of that healthy part of your brain that exists that you have a choice. And if you choose, you know, sort of your values over your OCD, for me, I mean, I was hanging on to probably 1%. 99% of my brain was OCD and screaming, and 1% kind of knew it wasn't real, but still wouldn't listen, you know, was afraid to listen to that little tiny voice. But it was enough. It was enough of a spark for me to create a fire out of. And I think the choice is very powerful. And before I forget, because I, you know, oh, medication. or maybe it's just old age. I don't know. Now that I've turned 40, it's all downhill. But see, I already forgot. That's how quick it goes. What was I going to say, Stuart?
I don't know. I don't worry. I do it all the time.
It was so good. It was so good. Anyway, you can continue. I'm sure it was interesting.
All right. Well, interrupt me if it comes back.
That will do.
Cool. No, I mean, it's good to hear that your therapist took different approaches to find what works, because I always say recovery is unique to the individual. What would be good is how did your approach to ERP change after starting ACT? Did you go back to doing it, or were you doing it the whole time?
This is why you're brilliant, because you automatically come back around to what I wanted to say and tie it in perfectly. So
cheers.
We love Stuart. It changed a lot. And what I wanted to say was that I think people that are struggling with OCD, suffering with OCD, and I still suffer. I mean, you know, we talk, we do our podcast, we do advocacy, and I think it's easy to look at us or feel like that, you know, everything is amazing and awesome. But life is difficult, especially with a mental illness. It flares up, it gets crazy, and we have our good days and bad days. We make good choices and bad choices. It's not a perfect science. But I think when you're in the throes of it, life feels like such a hard fight. And I think one of the questions we all ask ourselves, which is sort of a deterrent, is, am I going to have to fight this hard my whole life? Because this is exhausting. You know, and whether you're just starting therapy or you're 3 months in, and it's like every decision feels like a monumental task. you know, you start to question, what is this all for? And sort of the point I was going to make, and where this ties into what you're saying, is that for me, the ERPs became so much easier. My relationship to the ERPs became different because my relationship to my thoughts were different. I could better identify OCD's voice from Ethan's voice. I better understood that, you know, OCD was a disease, and that OCD and Ethan were two different people. It took me years afterwards to really sort of understand who Ethan was. And I'm still learning. I think that's a lifelong process of learning about yourself, but at least understanding Ethan's voice from OCD's voice. But in having that separation in thoughts and being able to use that ACT term, diffuse my thoughts and sort of get separation from the thoughts, really enabled me to intervene with ERP on my own and be my own, you know, therapist. And that made ERP and recovery that much more potent. And I mean, ACT to me today, as I say, was so crucial. But I would probably say that ERP is the reason I haven't relapsed, and it's because I constantly engage in ERPs, and where they've felt like monumental tasks when you're in the heart of it, you know, years later, they're almost involuntary for me. I don't realize I'm doing them. They're splits, you know, milliseconds at a time. Perfect example. I went to get lunch before I called you, and I was eating a salad. And I opened the fridge, and I'm on it. I've lost 15 pounds since you've seen me.
Oh, awesome. Congrats.
Yep. Got to get my body back, you know. Anyway, which I'm not even sure what that means, but we'll just go with it. But anyway, I was eating a salad and I wanted a ranch dressing. So I opened the fridge and my first thought is, when did you buy the ranch? How long has it been there? Is it still good? Because I'm always afraid, you know, food has gone bad, spoiled, E. coli, food poisoning. So then I have a pause occurs, and it's a very quick pause, but in my brain it feels very slow, and it's this moment where for that fork in the road where I decide, you know, do I just want to avoid the ranch today and I'll get that – open up that new dressing that's sitting there, or, you know, do I pretty much know the truth and willing to live with the uncertainty and embrace it and use the ranch? And The good news, the one thing I can say for having a really extreme journey is that my self-talk is really extreme, Stuart. It's sort of this. It's like, well, I can choose to use the other dressing and go back to a psych ward, or I can use the ranch that I'm afraid of and throw up and move on with my life. I think I'll use that ranch. That's literally the dialogue in my head pretty much every time. Like, oh, I could go back to that crack house and almost die, or I can just, you know, go that – and but it all happens within a millisecond. So whereas you feel stuck in the middle of these ERPs and you feel like you're climbing Mount Everest with every decision, that probably happened in 5/10 of a second. And I grabbed the ranch, poured it on, ate. Did I feel a little anxiety? Sure. But I didn't – my focus shifted. I didn't care because at the end of the day, the life that I have now – and I'm serious when I say I would rather die than go back to where I was before. And so if in my mind dying means taking a risk like eating the ranch dressing, which seems completely illogical, you know, then I'm willing to do that because I don't want to go back to where I was before. So ERP is crucial for me in maintenance. And I use it multiple times a day, every day, along with mindfulness and meditation and being present-minded and observing nature. And I've been walking a lot and I like being bored. That's my new thing is like I want to be bored. Because I don't think we're too stimulated. So when I go on walks, I make sure to not listen to music, just listen to nature, listen to my footsteps, listen to breathing. If I'm uneasy, if I get dizzy, if I get nauseous, like just kind of be in tune for a minute. And it's all really beneficial.
Yeah, I mean, that's a really good point there about potentially us being overstimulated. Obviously, I don't have the science to back that up, but I agree with you on that. Even I notice it now with my phone. You know, it constantly grabs my attention. I hate the fact that I have this urge to pick up the phone, even though I don't really care. But it's like, I don't want to say an addiction because that's too extreme for how I feel about my phone. But like the urge is there. And it's, you know, I don't like the fact that it has that hold over my brain. So doing things like you said, nature's a big one for me as well. I want to clarify one thing, actually, because you said about I'd rather die than go back to that crack house. And because you haven't mentioned it, but
No,
you
please do,
weren't
yes.
referring to the psych ward as a crack house. I want to caveat that.
No,
You.
no, 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 no. Sorry, Rod Stewart. No, I was not referring to the psych ward as a crack house. There were a lot of negatives to the psych ward. I don't recommend going there, especially the ones in Florida. I've heard the ones in Southern California are much nicer. So if you're going to break down, do it out here. But yeah, no. When I got tossed out of the OCD Institute, and I moved into this house that I found on Craigslist, I lovingly refer to it as the crack house, just because it was so, a disgusting place. There were people doing drugs there, the roommates or whatever. And so, yeah, I refer to it as the crack house. So that's what I was talking about.
Cool.
I would rather not go back to those 6 days in bed.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I didn't want a load of emails, people kicking off that you called a psych ward's crack houses. Okay,
You haven't
let's.
heard that term? It's the latest thing. Yeah.
Okay, so yeah, we covered a lot here. So you've mentioned obviously continuously doing. Well, actually, one other thing before I go on to that next question is where you talked about what was the example? Oh, the ranch dressing, and you weighed it up and you said, you gave the two options, and the one was okay. The worst, I can eat this and I'll end up being sick, and then I'll go on with my day, or I can have the other dressing, avoid this one, and end up back at the psych ward, and I think that. Is that was a healthy balance, because now you're saying actually, I think when a lot of people have OCD, originally they avoid because, they don't want to be sick, whatever it is, they don't want to get ill because of this dressing potentially, but they never think about actually what am I losing as well, or what is potentially, how is my life going to get worse? And that's what you did in that moment. And I think that's the more people can start to do that, balance those decisions, the easier it is to make the healthier choice.
That's a great point. I also do my best to not negotiate with OCD. And I think it's very easy in the moment to say to yourself, oh, well, it's not going to hurt just this once. And I mean, diet's the perfect example. You'd spend 2 days off your diet, suddenly you've gained, 30 pounds back. And I think OCD works the same way. I think if you start an avoidance, even if it's a micro avoidance, like, using your foot to open a bathroom door or whatever, and you just kind of open that can of worms, I feel like it's a very dangerous proposition. And, I personally am not willing to open that can of worms. So for me, making that extreme is what's helpful in making those decisions. And so, it may seem extreme. Like listeners could say, "Oh, well, come on. Even if you chose to use that, if you chose to not use that ranch dressing, you wouldn't end up back in a psych ward." You're probably right. From that one action, I probably wouldn't. But that one action is the beginning of many actions that would lead me down that path again. And, I'd already been there once. So it's just recognizing, I think, when you have opportunities to fight it. Because what's interesting is when you do fight it and fight it head on from the beginning, especially when you're in maintenance, it disappears a lot quicker. It's really interesting. The way OCD behaves is really interesting. I was driving home 3 or 4 weeks ago from my therapist, and I hit a bump in the road, and I had the thought, what if I hit somebody? Now, I've never had that kind of OCD before. I've never had the thought. I've never worried, but I genuinely, like, my heart was racing. What if I hit someone? And I thought about looking in my rearview mirror to check, and I was like, I'm not going down that road, because that's just a can of worms I can't afford to open. And so he's dead. Pretty sure it's a pothole, but if not, he'll bleed out, and I'm going to go on with my day. And it was interesting because maybe within 10 or 15 seconds, I completely forgot about it. And it's because it's when you, like, face it head on and just shut the lid right away, it really just pushes it back, as opposed to giving it that inch, because it'll take a mile.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Yeah, OCD is part of our brain, and ultimately that part of the brain is just it's overcautious because it doesn't want us to hurt ourselves or someone else or whatever. But it's in a way it's easily, what's the word? This isn't the word, but adjustable, adaptable. Like it will change in time. Because if it didn't, then ERP and ACT and things like that wouldn't, or medication wouldn't make a difference.
Right. And that's what's important to know, that the symptoms, that's why it's important to say that the symptoms don't really matter. The symptoms are a means to access the exposure and response prevention. And really, you know, it can be any symptom that you can just fill in the blank and pop in the skill set and just use those skills and those tools that you've learned. And so, you know, I think it's important to hit that home because the OCD is going to morph. I like to say, you know, there's been studies, Dr. Grayson always says that, you know, OCD people have above average intelligence, above average creativity, and vivid imagination. And, you know, that means that OCD has, it has access to the same weapons that we do. And so it's like we have to face our, sort of like that's Superman 3 from the 1980s where he has to fight himself. You know, he's just as strong. And so it's like, you know, if OCD has access to the same brain and same school tools and skills and weapons that I have, looks like I'm not even going to let it out of its cage, because then it's going to be a heck of a match and I'm not interested in that. I got more important things to do.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's a really good way of looking at it. Yeah, I've never heard that quote before.
Yeah, I didn't. I just
what just came made out. It up.
Yeah, I don't. Me neither. But as we talked about it, yeah. It's sort of it. You know, it can be used for good or evil. So,
I agree. Okay, so you mentioned obviously constantly doing ERP, and just a brief highlight there. You said how quickly, you know, your brain almost kicked in and did the exposure without you even having to think about it. And that is, it just becomes a skill. It becomes automatic. The more you do something, whether it's OCD or ERP, it becomes automatic. And you've done ERP for so long that your brain instantly now says, nope, not doing that. I'm going to go towards my fear, which I just think is a point to highlight, that it's not something you have to consciously necessarily do for the rest of your life. It becomes just natural and you automatically do it. Kind of like an antivirus software. It just kicks in when it notices there's a virus.
Well, for Mac at least, for PC, it slows you down down, and like, you know, who knows what that does to your day. But to tip off what you were saying also, you know, the other thing is that the ERP itself, that decision. Oh, what was I going to say, Stuart?
ERP.
Yeah, decision. I don't want.
All right.
You know how hard it is to like just tell you to go on because we're recording this, as opposed to like let's sit and let me try to think about it for 5 minutes.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Let me know if it goes. Oh, go on.
Yeah. I remember.
Okay.
So, what's cool is the ERP's ability, to sort of you don't need to re-trigger yourself. So in ERP, when you're engaged in ERP right now, that transition was terrible, but I actually remember what you say. So anyway, when you're doing ERP, you know, you engage in the ERP, and then the goal is to re-trigger yourself and re-trigger yourself again and re-trigger yourself again. But at a certain point, just like with anything, too much of one good thing can become maladaptive. It can become unhealthy, and it's the truth for ERP. Therapy, too much therapy can be unhealthy. So at a certain point, you know, when I'm going to get that ranch and I choose to get it and my anxiety subsides, I don't need to re-trigger myself. It's not important because I'm engaged in life. I'm engaged in living. I have things to do. And I'm at a point in my treatment where it's not necessary. Just that one act of resisting the compulsion and engaging in decisions and focus and behavior that's in line with my value is good enough. So that's the other thing, is that, you know, the ERP becomes involuntary, but then there's no need to, you know, further engage the ERP. It really just becomes a part of life, and you know, it goes from there.
Yeah, good point. I like it. Okay, so just briefly, if we missed anything else in so with kind of maintenance and pushing on in recovery, what's beyond kind of, you mentioned nature there, you mentioned mindfulness, and obviously doing exposures ad hoc, is there anything else you feel you do currently or have done that has been good for your mental well-being generally?
You know, I think that something I'm not good enough at doing is self-compassion. I think that I'm not good at that. I think it's a necessary part of recovery and staying in recovery. I think that people who struggle with OCD by nature are hard on themselves. You know, whether it's work or relationships or whatever. And I think, giving yourself permission to, I like to say permission to learn rather than permission to fail, because I tend to always learn from things that don't work out. And so is that really a failure? But I think giving yourself permission to not excel or achieve or, you know, have the outcome be the way you envisioned it. And being okay with that, just like you have to be okay with the uncertainty of life. I think the self-compassion aspect for me is probably something that I have to continue to work on, but is such a huge part of it, because I think if you're too hard on yourself, you know, that's also very dangerous, and you can sort of spiral down a dark place as you beat yourself down, as opposed to, you know, forgiving yourself and finding that balance between not giving yourself permission to do something that's not healthy, but to recognize that you maybe didn't make such a great decision, as in, you know, cheating on a diet, or maybe I did choose to get that other dressing. Maybe tomorrow I do choose to get that other dressing. And, you know, recognizing that that wasn't a healthy decision, being mindful of that, but not beating myself up over it, that we all make mistakes, and being able to move forward. I think that's the other big thing, and something that I struggle with, but constantly try to work on.
Yeah. Yeah. Good point. We're all human at the end of the day. And I think we forget that. I think we think we're robots and we're not. We falter, we fail, we learn. And I think there was a good point you said about not seeing it as a failure, but seeing it as a learning. Because I think often when you succeed in life, at least straight away, I can speak for myself at least, I don't learn. I only learn when I quote unquote fail. And then I have to reflect, and I have to say, okay, well, what went wrong? What could I have done better? And then I'm a better person, or better at whatever it is, because of it. And as painful as that failure may be, it's ultimately the greatest thing for my overall long-term happiness, success, whatever word we want to use. So yeah, I like that message.
I wrestled with that recently. I mean, I think I asked myself, why does growth have to come out of, you know, sort of trudging through the mud of life? You know, I saw something coming where I was going to be a fight head on. And I was like, why can't I just be drinking mojitos in the Seychelles and suddenly have some epiphany growth experience where I become a better person? Why does it take X, Y, and Z and turmoil and strength and all this craziness to grow? But you know what? That's the way it works. And I got to tell you, and I'm sure you can relate, you know, when you've been sidelined by OCD or any mental illness, frankly, and then you finally get to engage life, you sort of embrace the good and the bad of it. And I think being able to learn from those experiences in life, being able to just engage in them, because, I mean, really, when you're riddled with OCD, you are on the sidelines. You're not engaging in life. You're barely existing at its worst. Yeah. And so you know, I try to remember that, and I try to be grateful even in the difficult times, because ultimately I know that even though it's hard now, something good is going to come out of it. I've yet to not see a silver lining. So it may be annoying, it may be irritating, it may be painful, it may be heartbreaking, you know, whatever, how intense it is. But at the end of the day, something beautiful generally always comes from it. And that's sort of life's little miracles.
Yeah, no, I really like that. And to quote an old Prime Minister of the UK, Winston Churchill, he said, "It's darkest before dawn."
I summon my inner Winston. Yes.
Yeah, yeah. I love that quote, because it's, you know, it is really dark, and then suddenly you get this beautiful sunrise. And maybe I'm annoying a lot of people with this metaphor analogy, but I like to remember that. So,
and also, yeah. Go on.
I was going to change.
I was just going to quickly add, and you know what? Sometimes that dawn is not right away. Sometimes it's the next day or weeks or even years, but one day when it happens, you look back and go, oh, that's why. And it all makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. Good point. And without pain, happiness wouldn't be happiness. Wouldn't be joy, because you wouldn't have anything to compare it against.
Although without tallness, I wouldn't be short. So it's like, you know, it's, I don't know. I could be without a few things. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Okay, fair enough. Okay, so a couple questions at the end. So what would you, if you could pick up the phone and call your 20-year-old self, what would you say to him?
Wow, I would say ERP. That's probably it. God, you know, I don't know what the rules are to calling your 20-year-old self and what information you're allowed to give and what you're allowed not to give. But I think two things, honestly. I think obviously directing myself to the right treatment, and also at that age, I think that you feel like all of life is ahead of you and you feel a bit invincible. And that's a dangerous place to be, because I think you feel like you have time to sort of fight this insidious illness, and you know, I can deal with it later. And it's that later when it becomes far worse. And, you know, and so I would remind myself, you know, not only to go find a clinician that does ERP, but to then latch onto it and hold it with all your might and to engage it, because, you know, it is malignant and it will get severely worse. And, you know, you don't have to lose all of this time. I sort of look at it like an investment. You know, if I'm given $1 million, I can either spend it right now and I have a great time, but then what have I got at the end? You know, I've got nothing. Or I can invest it, and I may be painful now because I may still have to work, but 5-10 years down the road, it starts to pay out lifelong. And that's what I feel like ERP is like. I feel like in the short term, it is painful. You don't get to spend that money up front, but you're making an investment that pays out lifelong.
Yeah. Yeah, really, really good way of looking at it. You've got a billboard in Los Angeles where you're based. What do you want written on that billboard for everyone to see?
Oh, man. I feel like I'm on the Inside the Actor's Studio with James Lipton. You went up the gates of heaven. Okay, wow. What would I want that billboard to see, to say? If I can, you can too.
Nice. Yeah, good. I like
probably
it. Yeah. And
for a great first date call, and then, you know, still, I mean, why not? You know, it's dating in LA is a really tough, so just.
Yeah, true.
Take advantage. If you're paying for the billboard, I might as well like have a small corner for that.
Well, yeah, I'll see what the I can rustle up from the bank account.
Anybody see Three Billboards and?
Yeah, that was a great film.
It was great. Anyway.
Okay, so last question is just what advice do you have for people just who want to live a good life? So I guess kind of assuming they've got treatment under control. Just any words of wisdom for living a good life, best life.
Yeah, I think that it comes down to the self-compassion and understanding that, as Stuart said, that you are human and it's not a perfect science. I think it's easy to buy into the stigma of mental illness. I think it's easy to blame yourself when you have a lapse, as I call it, or a road bump, and sort of get down on yourself and feel like that it's your fault. I know I do. You know, I'm an advocate. I speak all over the place. I talk about stigma all the time, and yet when I struggle and I find it a little bit harder to live during a day, I start to blame myself. Like, why am I weak today? Why am I, you know, well, there is no why. The only why is that I have a disorder. I have a neurobiological disease. It's OCD. And that's why. And that's the only why that I need to know. And so I think, you know, being gentle with yourself and reminding yourself that you're going to have good days and bad days, that's all part of the behavior of OCD. But as you get better, there's lots more good days than there are bad. And to just be accepting and kind and gentle with yourself when you have those bad days and to continue moving forward. That's probably the best advice I could give.
Yeah, pretty good. Lastly then, so is there anything that I haven't asked you that you wish you could have shared that you want to share now?
I really appreciate you having me on for a second time. I think for those of you that haven't met Stuart, he's an extremely warm, sincere, real, and a really brilliant, smart guy. And I think the OCD community is very lucky to have him and all that you do. So I want to thank you for all that you do, for raising awareness, for bringing sort of a voice to the voiceless, as Liz likes to say. And it's, you know, it's people like you that are, you know, going to make a difference. And we're here. You're not alone. And, you know, there's if you need resources, you're listening to this for the first time, you can go to www.iocdf.org. You can also go to peaceofmind.com. And then, Stuart, what's your website?
TheOCDStories.com.
Okay. And so there are resources out there, and there are people that will help. So don't give up.
Yeah, great, great way to end. And I really appreciate those kind words. It means a lot. Obviously, I got to know you in Denver, and I can reciprocate your comments. You know, your unwavering commitment to advocacy is inspiring. And just especially the way you talk about so openly about your story, especially the real darker parts. Darker, I mean that in, you know, the more areas where you suffered. I really appreciate and respect your vulnerability in that area, because I know that's tough for many people to do. So
there you have it. I hope you enjoyed my chat with Ethan. I certainly learned a lot. And don't forget, if you want to check out the member site, head over to theocdstories.com/join. Quick disclaimer, this podcast is not therapy, is not a replacement for therapy, and nor should it be. Please seek treatment from a trained professional. Take care.